Chapter 3. The Hospital. Continued. I have spoken of corporal punishment and those responsible for its administration because I obtained a very clear idea of the subject during my stay in hospital. Until then, my knowledge was entirely dependent upon hearsay. In our room were confined all military prisoners who were to receive the rods, as well as those from the local garrison. What I have written about corporal punishment took place during my time in prison. I am told that things are now very different, and that further reforms are contemplated. During my first few days, I watched all that went on around me with such greedy eyes that these strange customs, these men who had just been flogged or were about to be flogged, left upon me a terrible impression. I was worried and frightened. As I listened to the conversation or narratives of other prisoners on the subject, I asked myself questions which I tried in vain to solve. I wanted to know all about the various kinds of punishment and their degrees, and to learn what the convicts themselves thought about it. I tried to imagine the psychological condition of a man who had been flogged. It rarely happened, as I have already said, that the prisoner approached the fatal moment in cold blood, even if he had been beaten several times before. The condemned man experiences a fear which is very terrible, but purely physical, an unconscious fear which disturbs his moral nature. During my years of imprisonment, I was able to study at leisure those prisoners who were anxious to leave the hospital and undergo the remainder of their sentence. The interruption of the punishment is always required by the doctor assisting at the execution. If the number of strokes to be received is too great for them to be administered all at once, it is divided according to advice given by the doctor on the spot. It is for him to decide whether a prisoner is in a condition to undergo the whole of his punishment or if his life is in danger. 500, 1,000, and even 1,500 strokes with the stick may be administered at once, but if there is a question of 2,000 or 3,000, the sentence is carried out in 2 or 3 doses. Those whose backs had healed after the first series, and who were to undergo a second, were sad, sombre, and silent on the day they went out and the evening before. They were in a state bordering on torpor. They engaged in no conversation and remained perfectly silent. It is worthy of remark that prisoners avoid speaking to those who are going to be flogged, and certainly never make any allusion to the subject, either by way of consolation or in superfluous words. No attention whatever is paid to them, which is certainly the best thing for the prisoners. There are, however, exceptions. One convict, named Orlov, of whom I have already spoken, was sorry that his back did not heal more quickly. He was anxious to obtain his discharge and take the rest of his flogging, after which he would have to join a convoy and intended to escape during the journey. He had a passionate, ardent nature, which was concentrated upon that single object. A cunning rascal, he seemed very pleased when he entered hospital. He was, however, in a state of abnormal excitement, though he endeavoured to conceal it. He had been afraid of being left on the ground and of dying before he had undergone half of his punishment. While standing his trial, he had heard that the authorities were taking certain measures in his case, as a result of which he thought he could not survive. But having received the first dose, his courage revived. When he arrived at the hospital, I had never seen such wounds, but he was in the best spirits. He now hoped to be able to live. The stories which had reached him were untrue, or the execution would not have been interrupted. He now began to think of a long Siberian journey, possibly of escaping to freedom in the fields and forests. 2 days after leaving hospital, he returned to die on the very couch which he had occupied during my stay there. He had been unable to support the second half of his punishment. For the rest, I have already spoken of this man. All the prisoners, without exception, even the most pusillanimous, even those who were tormented beforehand night and day with dread, faced suffering courageously when it came. I scarcely ever heard groans during the night following an execution. our people, as a rule, knew how to endure pain. I frequently questioned my companions about this pain in an attempt to discover with what kind of suffering it might be compared. It was no idle curiosity that urged me. I repeat, I was moved and frightened. But it was all in vain. I could get no satisfactory reply. "It burns like fire," was the general answer. They all said the same thing. First, I tried to question Emtsky. "It burns like fire, like hell. It seems as if one's back were in a furnace." One day, I reached an interesting conclusion, which may or may not have been well-founded, although the opinion of the convicts themselves confirms my view, namely, that the rods are the most terrible punishment in use among us. At first it seems absurd, impossible, yet 500 strokes of the rods, 400 even, are enough to kill a man. Beyond 500, death is almost certain. The most robust man will be unable to survive 1,000 strokes, whereas 500 with the stick are endured without much inconvenience, and without the least risk in the world of losing one's life. A man of ordinary build can take up to 1,000 with a stick without danger, and even 2,000 will not kill a man of ordinary strength and constitution. All the convicts declared that rods were worse than sticks or ramrods. "Rods hurt more, and for longer," they said. They must hurt more than sticks, that is quite certain, for they cause a far greater shock to the nervous system, which they excite beyond measure. I do not know whether such people exist today, but not long ago there were some who derived such pleasure from the whipping of a victim that they reminded one of the Marquis de Sade or the Marchioness Brinvilliers. I think such delight must consist in a kind of horror, that these noble ladies and gentlemen must have experienced pain and pleasure at the same time. There are people who, like tigers, are greedy for blood, those who enjoy unlimited power over the flesh, blood, and soul of their fellow creatures, of the brethren in Christ, those, I say, who enjoy that power, and can so utterly degrade another being made in the image of God, are incapable of resisting their desires and their thirst for excitement. Tyranny is a habit which may be developed until at last it becomes a disease. I declare that the noblest nature can become so hardened and bestial that nothing distinguishes it from that of a wild animal. Blood and power intoxicate. They help to develop callousness and debauchery. The mind then becomes capable of the most abnormal cruelty, which it regards as pleasure. The man and the citizen are swallowed up in the tyrant, and then a return to human dignity, repentance, moral resurrection, becomes almost impossible. It cannot be denied that the possibility of such license has a contagious effect on the whole of society. A society which looks upon such things with an indifferent eye is already infected to the marrow. In a word, the right granted to a man of inflicting corporal punishment on his fellows is one of the plague spots of our nation. It is the means of annihilating all civic spirit. It contains, in germ, the elements of inevitable, imminent decomposition. Society despises the professional executioner, but not one who is of gentle blood. Every manufacturer, every foreman, must feel a measure of satisfaction when he reflects that the workman and his family are entirely dependent upon him. A generation does not, I am sure, soon extirpate from itself what is hereditary. A man cannot renounce what is in his blood, what has been transmitted to him with his mother's milk. These revolutions are not quickly accomplished. It is not enough to confess one's fault, that is, very little indeed. It must be rooted out, and that takes time. I have spoken of the executioners. The instincts of an executioner exist potentially in almost every one of my contemporaries. But those animal propensities have not developed in all alike. When they stifle all other faculties, the man becomes a hideous monster. There are two kinds of executioner, those who choose the function and those upon whom it is imposed by duty or in virtue of their office. The former is in all respects more vile than the salaried executioner, upon whom, nevertheless, men look with repugnance, and who inspires them with disgust, with an instinctive and almost mystical terror. Whence comes this almost superstitious horror for the one, when the other is regarded with indifference, if not with indulgence? I know strange examples of honourable men, kindly and esteemed by all their friends, who yet saw fit to have a culprit whipped until he begged for mercy. It seemed quite natural to them, a measure recognised as indispensable. If the victim did not choose to cry out, his executioner, whom in other respects I should consider a good man, looked upon it as a personal affront. He meant, in the first instance, to inflict only a light punishment. But directly he failed to hear the habitual supplication, "Your Excellency, have mercy, be a father to me, let me thank God for you all my life," he became furious, and ordered 50 more strokes, hoping thus at last to force the desired appropriate howls and supplications. And at last they came. "Impossible! The man is too insolent," he cries in all seriousness. As for the official executioner, he is a convict chosen for this purpose. He is apprenticed to an old hand, and as soon as he knows his trade, he resides in the prison where he lives alone. He has a room which he shares with no one. Sometimes, indeed, he has a separate establishment, but he is always under guard. A man is not a machine. Although he whips by virtue of his office, he is sometimes maddened and beats for pleasure. Although he entertains no malice towards his victim, a desire to show his skill in the art of whipping may sharpen his vanity. He works as an artist. He knows well that he is a reprobate and that he excites universal superstitious dread. That very fact is bound to influence him and arouse his brutal instincts. Even little children say that the executioner has neither father nor mother. Strange. All the executioners I have known were intelligent men with a degree of self-conceit. The latter had developed as a result of that contempt with which they invariably met, and was strengthened, perhaps, by their consciousness of that fear with which they inspired their victims, and of their power over such unfortunate wretches as fell into their hands. It may well be, moreover, that the theatrical paraphernalia surrounding them gave rise to a certain arrogance. I had an opportunity, over a period of time, to meet and observe at close quarters an ordinary executioner. He was a man about 40, muscular, dry, and with an agreeable, intelligent face surrounded by long, curly hair. His manners were quiet and grave, and his general demeanour was in no way objectionable. He replied clearly and sensibly to every question I asked him, but with an air of condescension, as if he were in some way my superior. The officers of the guard addressed him with a respect which he fully appreciated, for which reason, in presence of his superiors, he became polite and more dignified than ever. He was never anything but studiously polite, though I am sure that when I spoke to him, he felt immeasurably superior to his interlocutor. I could read that in his countenance. Sometimes, in summer, when it was very hot, he would be sent under escort to kill dogs in the town with a long, very thin spear. These wandering animals multiplied with such prodigious rapidity and became so dangerous during the dog days that the authorities decided that the executioner be ordered to destroy them. This degrading office in no way injured his dignity. It was worth observing with what gravity he walked through the streets accompanied by his escort, how, with a single glance, he frightened the women and children, and how, from the height of his grandeur, he looked down upon the passers-by. Executioners enjoy a leisured existence. They have money to travel in comfort and drink vodka. They derive most of their income from presents slipped into their hands by condemned prisoners before execution. When they have to deal with a convict who is rich, They fix a sum to be paid in proportion to the victim's wealth, and will sometimes exact 30 rubles or more. The executioner has no right to spare his victim, and he does so at the risk of his own back, but for a suitable present he will agree not to strike too hard. He almost always receives what he asks, for in the event of refusal he will flog without mercy, as indeed he has the right to do. He may sometimes demand a large sum from a poor man. Then all the victim's relatives bestir themselves. They bargain, try to beat him down and implore his leniency, but woe betide if they fail to satisfy him. In such a case, the superstitious fear inspired by the executioner stands him in good stead. I had been told the most wonderful things, that, for instance, the executioner can kill his man with a single blow. "Is this your experience?" I asked. "Maybe. Who knows?" If any doubt remained, their tones seemed to convey the answer. They also told me that an executioner can strike in such a way that the victim will not feel the least pain, and without leaving a scar. Even when he has been bribed not to whip too severely, he administers the first stroke with all his might. It is the custom. He continues with less severity, especially if he has been paid handsomely. I do not know why this is done. It may be in order, as it were, to prepare the condemned for the succeeding blows, which will appear less painful by comparison, or it may be intended to frighten the criminal, so that he may understand with whom he has to deal, or it may be no more than vanity, to display the executioner's own strength. In any case, he is pleased with himself before an execution, and conscious of his power and vigour. He is the central figure of the drama. The public admires him and is filled with terror. Accordingly, it is not without satisfaction that he cries out to his victim, "Now then, you're for it!" Traditional and fatal words preceding the first blow. It is difficult to imagine a human being degraded to such a point. On my first day in hospital, I listened attentively to the convict stories which broke the monotony of the long days. In the morning, the doctor's visit was the first diversion. Then came dinner, which it will be believed was the most important episode of our daily routine. The portions varied according to each man's condition. Some received nothing but broth with groats in it, others only gruel, others a kind of semolina, which was much liked. The convicts ended by becoming soft and fastidious. The convalescents received a piece of boiled beef. The best food, which was reserved for the scorbutic patients, consisted of roast beef with onions, horseradish, and sometimes a small glass of spirits. The bread was, according to one's illness, black or brown. The precision observed in distributing the rations would make the patients laugh. There were some who took absolutely nothing. Portions were exchanged in such a way that the food intended for one patient was eaten by another. Those who were on low diet and received only small rations bought those of the scorbutic patients. Others would give any price for meat. There were some who ate two entire portions, but it cost them a good deal, for the usual price was 5 kopecks apiece. If no one in our room had meat to sell, the warder was sent to another section, and if he could obtain none there, he was asked to get some from the military infirmary, the free infirmary, as we called it. There were always patients ready to sell their rations. Poverty was the rule, and those who possessed a few kopecks used to send out to buy cakes and white bread or other delicacies at the market. Warders executed these commissions without reward. The most unpleasant period was that following dinner. Some went to sleep, if they had no other way of passing their time. Others either wrangled or told stories in a loud voice. When no new patients were brought in, things became exceedingly dull. The arrival of a new patient always caused a certain amount of excitement, especially when no one knew anything about him. He was questioned about his past life. The most interesting ones were the birds of passage. They always had something to tell. Of course, they never spoke of their own peccadilloes. If a prisoner did not volunteer information on that subject, no one asked questions. All he was asked was where he came from, who were with him on the road, what state the road was in, where he was being taken to, etc. Stimulated by the stories of the newcomers, our comrades in their turn began to tell what they had seen and done. The principal topics of conversation were the convoys, those in command of them, and the men who carried out sentences. About this time, that is to say towards evening, convicts who had been scourged came up. As I have said, their arrival always created something of a sensation, but it was not every day that we welcomed one of these, and everybody was bored to extinction when nothing happened to relieve the general sense of boredom. It seemed then as though the sick themselves were exasperated at the very sight of those near them. Sometimes they squabbled violently. The convicts were in high glee when a madman was taken off for medical examination. Those who had been sentenced to scourging sometimes feigned insanity in hope of escaping punishment. The trick was perhaps found out, or they themselves might voluntarily abandon the pretense. When that happened, men who for several days had done all sorts of wild things suddenly became steady and sensible people, quieted down, and, with a gloomy smile, asked to be discharged from hospital. Neither their fellow convicts nor the doctors spoke a word of protest against their deceit, or made the least reference to their mad pranks. Their names were put down on a list without a word being said, and they were simply taken elsewhere. After the lapse of some days, they returned, with their backs all wounds and blood. On the other hand, the arrival of a genuine lunatic was one of the most distressing sights. A mental patient who was gay and lively, who shouted, danced and sang, was at first greeted with enthusiasm. "Here's fun," said they, as they watched the grimaces and contortions of the unhappy wretch. But the sight was horrible and depressing. I have never been able to look upon a madman calmly or with indifference. There was one who spent 3 weeks in our room. We would have hidden ourselves had there been any place in which to hide. When things were at the worst, another case was brought in, and he affected me profoundly. In the first year, or to be more exact, during the first month of my exile, I went to work with a gang of kiln men to the tileries, which were situated 2 versts from prison. Our job was to repair the kiln in which the bricks were baked during the summer. That morning, Emtsky and B pointed out to me a non-commissioned officer who was superintendent of the works. This man was a Pole, already well on in years. He was at least 60. Tall, lean, of decent and even somewhat imposing exterior, he had done long service in Siberia. Although he belonged to the lower classes, he had been a soldier at the time of the 1830 rising. Emtsky and B loved and esteemed him. He was always reading the Vulgate. I spoke to him, and found his conversation agreeable and intelligent. He could tell an interesting story. He was straightforward and of excellent temper. For 2 years I never saw him again, but only heard that he had become a case, and that they were inquiring into it. And then, one fine day, they brought him into our room. He had gone raving mad. He came in yelling, shouting with laughter, and began to dance in the middle of the room with indecent gestures, which recalled the dance known as the Kamarinskaya. The convicts were wild with enthusiasm, but for my part, account for it as you will, I felt utterly miserable. 3 days later there was utter confusion. He picked violent quarrels with everyone, fought, groaned, and sang in the dead of night. His aberrations were so outlandish and disgusting as to make our very stomachs turn. He feared nobody. They put him in a straitjacket, but we were no better off, for he went on quarrelling and fighting all round. At the end of 3 weeks, we unanimously petitioned the chief physician to have the fellow transferred to the other convict ward. But after 2 days, the patients there had him moved back again. As there were now 2 madmen, Each ward continually passed them from one to the other until it was agreed that each should take one at a time, turn and turn about. Everyone breathed more freely when they were removed altogether. There was another lunatic whom I remember, a very remarkable creature. During the summer they had brought in a condemned man who looked like a solid and vigorous fellow of about 45 years. His face was sombre and sad, pitted with smallpox, and with little red swollen eyes. He settled in next to me. He was extremely quiet and spoke to nobody, and seemed utterly absorbed in his own deep reflections. When night fell, he addressed me, and, without a word of preface, told me in a hurried and excited way, as if he were confiding some awful secret, that he was to have 2,000 strokes with the rod, but that he had nothing to fear, as Colonel G.'s daughter was taking steps on his behalf. I looked at him with surprise, feeling sure that a colonel's daughter could be of little use in such a matter. I had not yet realized what was wrong with him, for he had been admitted to hospital as physically sick, not as a mental case. I then asked him from what illness he suffered. He answered that he knew nothing about it, that he had been sent here for some reason or other, but that he was in good health, and that the colonel's daughter had fallen in love with him. 2 weeks before, she had passed in a carriage before the guardhouse, where he was looking through the barred window, and had fallen head over heels in love at the mere sight of him. After that, she had visited the guardhouse 3 times on various pretexts. The first time she had come with her father, ostensibly to visit her brother, who was the officer on duty. On the second occasion, she had accompanied her mother to distribute arms to the prisoners. As she passed by, she had muttered that she loved him and would get him out of the prison. He told me all this nonsense with minute and exact details, all of it pure figment of his poor disordered brain. He believed wholeheartedly that his punishment would be graciously remitted. He spoke quite calmly and with full assurance of the passionate love he had inspired in the young lady. That odd romantic delusion about a young gentlewoman's love for a man of nearly 50 years, afflicted with a gloomy and disfigured face, only proved the terrible effect produced by fear of the punishment he was to receive upon this poor, timid creature. It may be that he had really seen someone through the bars of the window, and insanity, germinating under excess of fear, had taken shape and form in the present delusion. This unfortunate soldier, who, you may be certain, had never given a thought to young ladies, had begotten this romance in his diseased imagination, and clung convulsively to this desperate hope. I listened without interrupting him, and then repeated the story to other patients. They were naturally curious and questioned him, but he preserved a chastely discreet silence. Next day the doctor examined him. As the poor man swore there was nothing wrong with him, he was entered on the list of those to be discharged. When we learned that the physician had scribbled Sanat Est against his name, it was much too late to warn him. Besides, we were far from certain ourselves what was really the matter with the man. The error lay with the authorities who had sent him to us without specifying the reason for requiring his admittance to hospital, an unpardonable oversight. However, 2 days later, the unhappy creature was taken out to be scourged. We understood that he was dumbfounded by finding, contrary to his fixed expectation, that he really was to take his punishment. To the last moment he thought he would be pardoned, and when marched out in front of the battalion, he began to cry for help. As there was no longer room in our ward, they sent him to the infirmary. I heard that for 8 entire days he did not utter a single word, paralyzed with misery and bewilderment. When his back was healed, they took him away, and I never heard any more about him. As to the treatment of the sick and the remedies prescribed, those who were but slightly indisposed paid no attention whatever to doctors' orders and never took their medicine. Generally speaking, those who were more seriously ill were strict in their observance of medical advice. They took their mixtures and powders and looked after themselves with the greatest care, but they preferred external to internal remedies. Cupping glasses, leeches, cataplasms, bloodlettings, in all which things the common people have so blind a confidence, were held in high honour in our hospital. Inflictions of that sort were regarded with approval. I noticed a curious phenomenon which interested me. Men who could endure without a murmur the frightful tortures caused by the rods and scourges howled, grimaced, and moaned at the least little ailment. Whether it was all pretence or not, I really cannot say. We had cuppings of a quite peculiar kind. The machine with which instantaneous incisions are made was out of order, so they had to use the lancet. 12 incisions are necessary for a cupping. With a machine, these are not painful at all, for it makes them instantaneously. With the lancet, it is a different matter altogether. The lancet cuts slowly and causes the patient to suffer. If you have to make 10 openings, there will be about 120 pricks, and these are very painful. I myself had to undergo it. Besides pain, it caused great nervous irritation. But the suffering was not so great that one could not help groaning if one tried. It was laughable to see great hulking fellows wriggling and howling. One could not help comparing them with a certain type of man who is firm and calm enough in a crisis, but ill-tempered and capricious in the bosom of their families for no reason at all. If dinner is late, for example, they'll scold and swear. Everything annoys them, and they fall out with everyone. The more comfort they have, the more troublesome they are to other people. Characters of this sort, which are common enough among the lower orders, were all too numerous in prison, because each man's company was forced upon his neighbour. Sometimes the prisoners chaffed or insulted the tetchy fellows of whom I have been speaking. These would then hide their discontent. It seemed that a word of abuse was enough to bridle their tongues. Ustyantsev had no use for a man who whined under the lancet and never let slip an opportunity of rebuking the delinquent. Besides, he was fond of scolding. It was a sort of necessity with him, engendered by illness and also his stupidity. He would gaze at you fixedly for some time, and then treat you to a long speech of threatening and warning, all in a tone of calm and impartial conviction. It seemed as though he thought his function in this world was to watch over order and morality in general. "He must poke his nose into everything," the prisoners used to laugh, for they pitied him, and did what they could to avoid conflict with him. "Can he talk? Why, 3 wagons wouldn't be too many to carry away all his chatter." "Well, why not? No one's going to put up with a mere idiot. What's there to cry out about at the mere touch of a lancet? What harm in the world do you fancy that is going to do to you?" "Hear, hear," another man interrupts. "Cuppings are mere nothing. I know by experience. But the most horrid thing is when they keep pulling your ears. That just shuts you up." All the prisoners burst out laughing. "Have you had them pulled?" "By Jove, yes, I should think he had. That's why they stick upright, like hop poles." The fellow in question, Chapkin by name, certainly had long pointed ears. He had led a vagabond life, but was still quite young, intelligent, and quiet. He used to talk with a sort of dry humour and a show of gravity which made his stories most amusing. "How in the world was I to know you had had your ears pulled and lengthened, you brainless idiot?" began Ustyantsev, once more wrathfully addressing Chapkin, who, however, vouchsafed no attention to his companion's obliging apostrophe. "Well, who did pull your ears for you?" someone asked. "Why, the police superintendent, of course. Our offence was wandering abroad and sleeping in the open. We had just arrived at K. I and another tramp called Epitnya. He had no surname, that fellow. On the way, we had stayed a little while in the hamlet of Tolmina. Yes, there's actually a hamlet called Tolmina. Well, we get to the town and are just looking around to see if there's any business doing, after which we mean to flit. You know, out in the open country, you're as free as the air, but it's not exactly the same thing in the town. First we go into a public house, and as we open the door we give a sharp look round. What should we see but a sunburnt fellow in a German coat, all out at elbows? He walks straight up to us. After chatting about one thing and another, he asks us, "Excuse my asking, but have you passports?" "No, we haven't." "Nor have we. Incidentally, I've a couple of mates with me, also in the service of General Cuckoo." That is to say, tramps like himself, who wander through the forests and hear the birds sing. "We've been seeing a bit of life, and just now haven't a penny to bless ourselves with. May I take the liberty of asking you to be so good as to order a quart of brandy?" "With the greatest pleasure," we answer. So we drink together, and they tell us of a place where there's a real good stroke of business to be done, a house at the end of the town belonging to a wealthy merchant fellow. Lots of good things there. So we make up our minds and have a shot at it during the night. There are five of us, and just as we're starting on the job, they nab us, take us to the police station, and then before the superintendent. "I shall examine them myself," he says. He lights his pipe, and they bring him in a cup of tea. He was a sturdy fellow with whiskers. Besides us five, there were three other tramps just brought in. You know, comrades, that there's nothing in this world more funny than a tramp, because he always forgets everything he's done. You may cudgel his head till you're tired, but you'll always get the same answer, that he's forgotten all about everything. The police superintendent then turns to me and asks me squarely, "Who are you?" I answer just like all the rest of them. "I've forgotten all about it, sir." "Just you wait. I have a word or two more to say to you. I know your face." Then he gives me a good long stare, but I hadn't seen him anywhere before, that's a fact. Then he asks another of them, "Who are you?" "Mizzle and Scud, sir." "They call you Mizzle and Scud?" "Precisely that, sir." "Right, you're Mizzle and Scud. And you?" To a third.
"Along o' him, sir."
"But what's your name? Your name?"
"Me? I'm called Along o' him, sir."
"Who gave you that name, hound?"
"Very worthy people, sir. There are lots of worthy people about. No one knows that better than you, sir."
"And who may these worthy people be?"
"Oh, Lord, it's slipped my memory, sir. Please, please forgive me."
"So you've forgotten them, all of them, these worthy people?"
"Every mother's son of them, sir."
"But you must have had relations, a father, a mother. Do you remember them?"
"I suppose I must have had, sir, but I've forgotten about them. My memory's so bad. Now I come to think of it, I'm sure I had some, sir."
"But where have you been living till now?"
"In the woods, sir."
"Always in the woods?"
"Always in the woods."
"Winter, too?"
"Never saw any winter, sir."
"Get along with you. And you, what's your name?"
"Hatches and Axes, sir."
"And yours?"
"Sharp and Mum, sir."
"And you?"
"Keen and Spry, sir."
"And not a soul of you remembers anything that ever happened to you?"
"Not a mother's son of us anything whatever."
He couldn't help it. He laughed out loud. Then all the others began to laugh at seeing him laugh. But that doesn't always happen. Sometimes they lay about them, these police, with their fists, till every tooth in your jaw is smashed. Devilish big and strong, these fellows, I can tell you. "Take them off to the lock-up," said he. "I'll see to them in a bit. As for you," meaning me, "you wait here. Just sit down over there, will you?" Over there was paper, a pen and ink. So, thinks I, what's he up to now? "Sit down," he says again. "Take the pen and write." And then he goes and seizes my ear and gives it a good pull. I looked at him in the sort of way the devil may look at a priest. "I can't write, sir."
"Write! Write!
Have mercy on me, sir. Write your best. Write, write." And all the while, he keeps pulling my ear, pulling and twisting. Pals,
I'd rather have had 300 strokes of the cat. I tell you, it was hell. Right, right, was all he said.
Had the fellow gone mad? What the hell was he up to?
No, he wasn't mad. A little while before, a secretary had done a job at Tobolsk. He had robbed the local treasury and gone off with the money. He had very big ears, just as I have. They had published the fact all over the country. I answered to that description. That's why he tormented me with his right. He wanted to find out if I could write and to see my hand. A regular sharp chap, that. Did it hurt?
Oh, Lord! Don't say a word about it, I beg.
Everybody burst out laughing.
Well, did you write?
What the deuce was there to write?
I set my pen going over the paper and did it to such good account that he left off torturing me. He just gave me a dozen thumps, regulation allowance, and then let me go about my business. To prison, that is.
Do you really know how to write?
Of course I did.
What do you mean?
Used to very well. Forgotten the whole blessed thing, though, ever since pens came into fashion.
Thanks to the patient gossip, time passed fairly quickly. But even so, Lord, how wearied and bored we were. Those long days were suffocating in their monotony, one exactly like another. If only I had had a single book. For all that, I often went into hospital, especially in the early days of my imprisonment, either because I was ill or because I needed rest, just to get out of the barrack where life was indeed made burdensome, and which was far worse even than the hospital, especially as regards its effect upon moral sentiment and good feeling. We gentlemen were the abiding objects of envious dislike, incessant quarrels picked with us, ourselves forever in the wrong, and looks filled with menacing hate unceasingly directed at us. Here in the sick rooms, one lived on a sort of footing of equality. There was something of comradeship. The most melancholy moment of the 24 hours was evening, when night set in. We went to bed very early. A smoky lamp just gave us one point of light at the far end of the room near the door. In our corner we were in almost complete darkness. The air was pestilential, stifling. Some of the patients could not get to sleep. They would rise and remain for an hour together, sitting on their beds with their heads bent, as though in deep reflection. I used to watch them closely, trying to guess of what they might be thinking. Thus I tried to kill time. Then I became lost in my own reverie. The past came before me, showing itself to my imagination in large, powerful outlines filled with highlights and massive shadows. Details that, at any other time, would have remained forgotten, presented themselves with vivid force, leaving upon me an impression that would have been impossible under any other circumstances. Then I would begin to muse dreamily on the future. When should I leave this confinement, this dreadful prison? Whither betake myself? What would then happen to me? Would I return to the place of my birth? So I brooded and brooded, until hope revived in my soul. Another time I would begin to count, 1, 2, 3, etc., to see if sleep could be won that way. I would sometimes get as far as 3,000, and still be as wakeful as ever. Then someone would turn in his bed. Then there was Ustyantsev's coughing, that cough of the advanced consumptive. He would groan feebly, then stammer,
"My God, I've sinned. I've sinned."
How frightful it was, that voice of the sick man, that broken, dying voice in the midst of that silence, so dead and so complete. In a corner there are some patients not yet asleep, stretched on their pallets and talking in low voices. One of them is telling the story of his life, all about things infinitely far away, things that are forever fled. He is talking of his wandering through the world, of his children, his wife, and his life in the old days. And the very accent of the man's voice tells you that all those things belong to an irrevocable past,
that he is as a limb cut off from the body of mankind and cast aside. There is another listening intently to what he is saying. A weak, feeble sort of muttering and murmuring comes to one's ear from far off in the dreary room, a sound as of some distant river. I remember how, one winter's night that seemed as if it would never end, I heard a story which seemed at first like the stammerings of a soul in nightmare, or the delirium of fever. Here it is.